All rise. The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit is now in session. All persons having business before this honorable court may now draw near and they will be heard. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please remain standing for a rendition of Amazing Grace. Thank you. Please be seated. Good afternoon, everyone. Ladies and gentlemen, the court has convened this special proceeding for the purpose of memorializing the remarkable life and service of the Honorable Donald R. Ross, our esteemed colleague on the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. My name is William Riley, and I am the Chief Judge of the Eighth Circuit. First, I want to welcome you all to this memorial session of the court. Thank you for coming. Chief Judge Lori Smithcamp, to my right, of the United States District Court for the District of Nebraska, is also presiding and will speak to you in a moment. In 1970, President Richard Nixon nominated Donald R. Ross to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. The United States Senate unanimously confirmed that nomination. And Judge Ross began his service on this court on December 12, 1970, replacing Justice Harry Blackmun, who was named to the Supreme Court of the United States. Judge Ross served as an active judge on our court from 1970 to 1987. When he assumed senior status and continued to hear cases for the court until August 2001. You will soon hear more about the accomplishments and remarkable service of Judge Ross to this court, to the community and his family, and to our nation. One of my tasks is to introduce you to our Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals members and some of the other distinguished guests in attendance. First of all, to my left, Judge Roger Woolman of Sioux Falls, South Dakota. To my right, Judge C. Arlen Beam from Lincoln. To my far left, Judge James Loken from Minneapolis, Minnesota. And on the lower level, on my left, your right, is Judge Kermit Bai from Fargo, North Dakota. And next to him is Judge Levinsky Smith from Little Rock, Arkansas. Next to him is Judge Stephen Colleton from Des Moines, Iowa. And next to him is Judge Raymond Grunder of St. Louis. And next to him, Judge Dwayne Benton from Kansas City. And next to him, Judge Bobby Shepherd from El Dorado, Arkansas. Also with us today, we are privileged to have most of the members of the Nebraska Supreme Court. To begin with, we have Chief Justice Michael Hevekin. Why don't you stand up as we go down, if you would, please. Justice John Wright, Justice Lindsey Miller Lerman, Justice William Castle, and former Chief Justice C. Thomas White. We had the whole Supreme Court, and our whole court was going to be here, but we had a canceled airplane flight and some sicknesses and illnesses. Otherwise, we'd have had everyone here. Oh, and a wedding, too. Can you believe that? Our other distinguished guest I want to recognize is one of Judge Ross's former law clerks, who just got nominated, confirmed, and appointed to the United States District Court for the District of Connecticut, Judge Jeffrey Myers. Judge Myers? And we also have with us Dean Marianne Culhane from the Creighton Law School. Thank you. And the rest of these people, our distinguished guest, Judge Smith Camp, will tell you in a moment. Before I turn the introductions over to Judge Smith Camp, I want to tell you a couple stories about my predecessor and colleague, Judge Ross. Judge Ross's immediate successor was Judge C. Arlen Beam, to my right and to your left. And when Judge Beam took senior status, I was nominated and confirmed. So I'm a direct descendant, second generation of Judge Ross. But I want to go back a few years, 1971-72, when Judge Ross and Judge Lay, both of Omaha circuit judges, came to Lincoln to Nebraska Law School to interview potential law clerks. And they interviewed approximately half dozen, and chose two. And those two, the judges said, well, we don't care who you clerk for, but one for one of us and one for the other, you choose. Well, those two judges, or those two clerks, are now judges. One of them is Judge Richard Cuff. Where are you? Over here, okay. And the other was me. And so we decided, well, who would clerk for Judge Ross? And who would clerk for Judge Lay? And we made a very calculated, discerning agreement. Judge, I had a job. Rich Cuff did not have a job. And so we decided that Judge Lay had a two-year law clerk or Judge Ross did, and so Judge Cuff would take that. I would take the one-year law clerk position because I had a job. And you'll find out a little later, I think that Judge Cuff eventually went out and clerked in Judge Ross's old law firm. Now, going back to what I was telling you about the three generations of judges, Judge Ross to Judge Beam and to me. When I was sworn in, 5 days, actually 3 business days later, I got a word from Judge Fagg, and the court was sitting here in Omaha. Now, I didn't have a computer. I didn't have a legal pad. I didn't have a pencil. He walked in and says, I've got a conflict. And he was the only acting judge in a panel made up of Judge Ross and Judge Beam. And they came to me and he said, would you handle these two cases? Well, I didn't have a law clerk. So I had to read all that myself. And so I prepared and I came in to the robing room with Judge Ross, these people that I'd respected and looked up to for all these years, and Judge Beam, and they welcomed me. And Judge Ross said, well, Bill, you know, you're the only active judge. That means you have to preside. I said, oh, no. I'm not going to preside. I don't know what I'm doing. I've only been on the court for 5 days. And I said, I think the most senior judge should preside. And so Judge Ross presided the last time he sat on the court, the first time I sat on the court. We had three generations of judges, and Judge Ross was the courtroom right next door. And Judge Ross presided, and the people ran out and got pictures, and we have pictures of that. And Judge Ross was absolutely elated that he got to sit in the center and preside the last time that he sat. So, and I just point out, my law clerk, when I did get one, told me I'd violated federal law by looking, you know, not presiding. And I said, well, that's what you get from a Harvard education, because I was presiding from the left side. So I'm going to now turn this over to Chief District Judge Lori Smithgamp. Lori?
Thank you, Judge Riley. On behalf of the U.S. District Court, I welcome all of you here for this celebration of the life and the career of Judge Don Ross. As Chief Judge Riley mentioned, our MC today will be a former law clerk of Judge Ross, our Senior Judge Rich Kupf. And as you can tell from Judge Meyer and Judge Kupf's presence here today, some of the brilliance of Judge Ross rubbed off on his law clerks. And I see some of you nodding out there in the audience, and I assume you are also former law clerks of Judge Ross. Judge Kupf and Judge Riley are too modest to tell you this, but they are the ones who are hosting the reception down in the atrium after the ceremony here today, and so they are the individuals that you can thank for the punch and the cookies and the other things that you may have down there. I also want to introduce to you our other members of the district court bench. With us today is Judge John Girard, and there's Judge Girard, and next to him on his right is Senior Judge Warren Erbaum. And also with us today are Magistrate Judges Tom Tolkien and F.A. Gossett and Cheryl Zwart. And do we have our bankruptcy judge, Tom Saladino? He may be down in Lincoln today, working hard in Lincoln. Senior Judge Lyle Strom was unable to join us, but he did prepare a letter that I want to share with you. It says, to the family and friends of Judge Ross, I regret that I am out of town this week and am not able to attend the memorial ceremony dedicated to Judge Ross. He was a good friend and a great judge. When I was in private practice, I always looked forward to appearing before Judge Ross. He listened carefully to what the attorneys had to say, and it was clear that he was prepared for the arguments, as demonstrated by the questions he asked the lawyers. He was certainly a well-respected appellate judge. I recall that at the time I was being considered as a successor to Judge Schatz, Don made arrangements for me to visit with the Assistant Attorney General in Washington, D.C., who was second in command. I believe to this day that the interview was key to my receiving the nomination of President Reagan. I remember him fondly. Judge Ross, his family, and friends are in my prayers today. Very truly yours, Lyle E. Strom, Senior Judge, United States District Court. I also want to recognize today Stu Dornan, who is the president of the Omaha Bar Association, and also Mike Fenner, who is the president of the Nebraska State Bar Association. We are very glad you could join us today. Now, most important, a number of the members of Judge Ross's family are here. His daughter Jane Moody and husband Randy, his daughter Sharon Steffen, and husband Ken, who's going to be speaking a little bit later today. His daughter Becky, who will speak later, and her husband Dennis Linder. His daughter Joni Wilson and her husband Tom. And his son Dean and his wife Sharon. Don and Janice Ross also were the proud grandparents of 14 grandchildren and 17 great-grandchildren, and many of them are here with us today to celebrate the legacy of the family patriarch. Now, Judge Ross gave Judge Cupp some instructions about this memorial gathering, and I understand that that is why I'm up here today among all these other judges who outrank me. I can only assume that Judge Ross wanted me to share a little information with you about his years in the 1950s and 60s when he was a member of the law firm of Swohr, May, Royce, Smith, Anderson, and Ross, because I worked with him during those years. Now, Don's daughters will agree that the lawyers in that law firm didn't really care about child labor laws when it came to using their daughters. I don't know about Dean. I don't think that they did this with sons so much. But the daughters worked as receptionists in the law firm on Saturday mornings and during the summertime so that the secretaries could take vacations. And it gave us an appreciation for the work that secretaries do and the work that other support staff members do. And it also gave us some insight into how a law firm operates. And I observed at a very early age that Don Ross was a leader, he was a manager, and he was a rainmaker. And to this day, I am grateful to Don Ross for indirectly helping to put me through college and through law school. So thank you all, members of the Ross family. Don was also a man who exhibited the highest ethical standards, and he would tolerate nothing less from anyone else in the firm. How many of you are old enough to remember the year 1968? Few of you, okay. In many ways, it was a year of chaos and tragedy, but Don was a man who had the ability to bring order out of chaos and create harmony in times of discord. As the vice chairman of the Republican National Committee, Don was responsible for organizing the National Convention in August of 1968. In the rest of the country, there were riots in the streets, but in August of 1968, in Miami, Florida, there was peace, hope, love, harmony, and good order, because for one bright, shining moment in history, Don Ross was in charge. Jane, Sharon, Becky, Joni, Dean, I know you are very proud of your dad, and you should be, and I am proud and grateful to have known him. Now, ladies and gentlemen, Chief Judge Riley has anything further to say, I give you your Master of Ceremonies, Senior Judge Richard Cupp.
Thank you. Several years ago, when Judge Ross was less frail than he was at the end, he called me and he said, Rich, my boy, I was then 60. And I said, yes, sir. Yes, Judge. He said, you need to come to Omaha to talk to me. And I said, well, fine, Judge. What shall we talk about? He said, well, of course, we need to talk about what happens when I croak. Now, you heard Judge Smithcamp talk about the judge's planning abilities. And so I knew exactly what he was talking about. And so I went to Omaha. I remember lugging some donuts, and the judge and Janice and I sat down to eat donuts and talk about what happened when he croaked. Janice was very helpful. As Rebecca remarked yesterday, she was a pretty good party planner herself. And they thought very deeply about what this ceremony ought to look like. And so it's with those things in mind that I begin. The judge wanted, and Janice wanted particularly, to have Judge William Webster speak. I don't think there has been in the 20th century and early part of the 21st century a judicial figure more distinguished than Judge William F. Webster, Judge Ross's dear friend. Judge Webster was a United States attorney for the Eastern District of Missouri from 1960 to 1961. In 1970, Judge Webster was appointed a judge of the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Missouri. And in 1973, he became Judge Ross's colleague on the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. 5 years later, President Jimmy Carter appointed him as director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And as an aside, if you see the movie American Hustle, who's seen it? Raise your hand. Judge Wes Webster was the FBI director when Abscam was investigated. In 1987, President Ronald Reagan chose the judge to be director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and he led the CIA until his retirement from public office in 1991. Judge Webster served in the Navy during World War II and again during the Korean War. Judge Ross would be enormously pleased by Judge Webster's presence. And Judge, we look forward to your remarks.
Thank you very much, Judge Kemp. Chief Judge Riley, Chief Judge Kemp Smith, and may it please the court and the families of Don Ross, our dear friend. I'm really honored to be here today and to speak about our friend, one of America's great judges, an extraordinary person of example to all of us, and one that I shall remember and cherish in all my remaining days. We had interesting careers. He was 2 years older than I, and with that caveat, he moved fast in a rapidly changing world, and I was always two steps behind, not trying to catch up with him and simply trying to do my duty. But we came together some 44 years ago, and what follows now is just simply my recollections, not of the cases he tried or heard, but of the years of learning from him and sharing friendship with him and learning to have an appreciation for what this court means to the country. We were both in college at the time Pearl Harbor erupted. Don moved faster than I did, immediately enlisted, came home from overseas, enlisted in the Air Force, and was soon an officer and accomplished bombardier. Did two terms, I think you may hear about this later, many missions over Europe, highly decorated, and then returned to finish his law education. My period at that time was much less distinguished. I did enlist in the Navy. I did become an officer and serve during World War II, but nothing of the kind that would accomplish what he did. And then I went back to law school, and the Navy felt at the time the Korean War broke out they couldn't do without me, so they called me back for 2 years, and they gave me a chance to try to catch up with him. Meantime, he was the mayor of Lexington, Nebraska, and leading the Republican Party at a time when it might have been a disaster for the Republican Party in the direction it was going, but for his wise and good counsel in bringing it back to the center of reality. And for that, I am also grateful. Naturally, he got to be U.S. Attorney before I did. And he served brilliantly until 1956. My time did not come until 1960. But I think it was a common experience that we both had that when we finally did get together, shared values of what it meant to be on that side and that in that role in government service, and for what, which his observations were always to the point and very, very fair. I'm told that in 1970 he turned down an opportunity to be a district judge, but it wasn't for long that he was called for a higher calling. I did not turn down the opportunity in 1970, and so it was, that is how we came together. I was a United States District Judge in St. Louis. St. Louis was the seat of this court, as most of you know, and it gave me a unique opportunity to kind of play host to this distinguished court when it came to St. Louis on its assignments, and I shall always be grateful for that. Don was one of those that I had the privilege of knowing, not only on the bench, not only in consideration of the cases, but also a little bit of fun, a little golf, a little tennis, which I could supply and which he loved to do. I came to know him better, and he was an example to me particularly, and I mention this now perhaps out of order from my notes, but how much he cared about his law clerks. They were part of his family, and you just heard from one of them before me. He valued their opinions. He expected them to perform with diligence and excellence, and they did. And that was a huge example to me, as in the years that following, I made it a point always to have what we called elbow clerks with me, and I took them with me into the FBI and into the CIA, and not long ago I celebrated a big birthday, and many of them were there, and I was so proud of what they had been able to do with their lives, just as Don was proud of the extremely successful law clerks who had the privilege of serving with him. I'm underlined a note of 1973 when I followed him to the court. We had then the pleasure of sitting together. I learned from him how to be fair, how to be on time, but mostly how to be prepared and to do so in a way that brought, I thought, good results on all occasions. He was always prepared. And those 5 years that I was privileged to serve with this honorable court were three or five of the happiest years of my life. Only Judge Bright, who will be with us in spirit and on the tube today, I think, are still around. And that's a sad thought for me, but I've been happy and proud of the way this court has served the country and served the law so brilliantly and so consistently over the years. Then in 1978 came a huge decision for me. I was being urged by the Attorney General, Griffin Bell, by the Solicitor General, Wade McCree, a brilliant African-American on the sixth from the Sixth Circuit and one of my dearest friends, and a little less enthusiastically by the Chief Justice, to take on the role of the director of the FBI. The Bureau was in some difficulties at that time, allegations of black bag jobs and other things that were around. And I kept pushing it off, saying, don't do me any favors, until I talked to Don Ross. And Don said, if it were me and I could do it, I would do it, and you should do it. He didn't have to say much more than that. So I moved on for another 9 years. In the meantime, we stayed in reasonably close touch with each other. I visited, he was having some health issues, and I visited him with my wife in Arizona when he was there looking for some assistance. And then again, I didn't see him in Alexandria, Minnesota, which he loved, but I was able to keep in touch with him then and see how he was doing. He really struggled with his back problems and others, but it did not keep him from doing his duty. Finally taking senior status in 1987, which was the year that I moved at the request of President Reagan to the CIA. So we stayed a little more in touch. But by 2001, I think Don had fully completed his responsibilities. But think of those years from 1970 to 2001, a member of this court and a proud member of this court. These are the kinds of things we think about, what qualifies a good judge. I don't have the answer to that question, but I knew one. And I knew what it meant for him to have served so brilliantly, not only as a judge, but in previous life as a military officer who loved his country, and as a official and state, local, and party leader. All of those things, I think, helped shape his view of the country and where he should be in terms of the law. When I hear Judge Learned Hand's quotation cited from time to time, I think of Don Ross, who said, when he said, "Descended to us in some part molded by our hands, passed on to succeeding generations with reverence and with pride, we at once its servants and its masters renew our fealty to the law." That was Don Ross. He loved this court. He loved the law. He served it honorably throughout a long and useful life. I forgot to mention how much we enjoyed knowing his lovely wife and then her children as they grew up. Janice was sweet to all of them, sweet to my children. And then I heard this morning about 17 great-grandchildren. I'm still struggling with my first one, waiting for another one in May. I didn't catch up there at all. But I shall remember him as you have. I think this is one of the nicest gatherings of people in honor of departed judges that I can remember over a lot of years, and he richly deserved it. I think of him in another way, too, if I may borrow another one, from the lines of America the Beautiful, the passage about, "O beautiful for hero's sake, eliminating strife, who more than self their country loved, and mercy more than life." Today we salute a great American, a great jurist, and for many of us here, a true and loyal friend. Thank you.
Do you remember The Odd Couple? Felix and Oscar. Well, how about Don and Mike? We're going to have a presentation now from Judge Bright. I believe the judge said he'd come, Chief Judge Riley, if you paid for first class air, right?
That's right.
No, that's not true. Well, it's only partially true. The judge is I think, in Arizona or California, and traveling is a bit difficult for him. So if our superb IT people, there's one of them, he's going to cue up Judge Bright's remarks. Judge Bright?
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm delighted to be here at this memorial service for Judge Donald R. Ross. He was a great friend. I want to thank my chief, Chief Riley, for inviting me to speak at this ceremony. And I have special greetings to all of Judge Ross's friends and family, and of course, to my colleagues who are here, and to the many other judges, state and federal, who are attending this affair. You know, actually, I'd like to be here in person, but you'll have to accept my spirit through digital photography and movie making as a substitute. As a matter of fact, this presentation was made January 17th, 2014, in Fargo, North Dakota. And right now, I'm in California taking therapy for my leg situation. Legs, I should say. Let me open by saying that Tom Brokaw, a few years ago, wrote a book called The Greatest Generation. And in it, he paid tribute to those of us, like Judge Ross and myself included, who were born after World War I, lived through a depression, served for our country in World War II, and after the war, made a life for ourselves, our family, and to some extent, I think, a better United States of America. Judge Ross and I were friends, and I know many will speak of Judge Ross's great accomplishments in his first almost 50 years, when he was a graduate of the Nebraska schools, when he served in World War II as quite a hero, and then his great work for the GOP Republican Party in Nebraska and in these United States. I have to tell you that he was an outstanding judge, and I probably will start sort of near the end. After serving some 16 and a half years as an active judge, he took senior status. And at our judicial conference in Colorado Springs in 1987, shortly after Judge Ross had assumed this new position of senior status, we had a rendition of a expression of appreciation for his work, which I'll read to you in part. Perhaps the greatest tribute to Judge Ross's accomplishments and talents came in 1971, when he was appointed by President Nixon to the United States Court of Appeals. He succeeded Harry Blackmun, who was appointed and took a position on the United States Supreme Court. As a member of the Eighth Circuit, Judge Ross has written more than 1,000 opinions in all areas of the law, many of them of great significance. He likes to call himself a judicial conservative, but he has displayed perceptive sensitivity to the discrimination suffered by minorities and women in obtaining equal rights and privileges in our society. His opinions demonstrate a blend of scholarship and wisdom based on notions of what is practical and just. We call Ross the Big Bear. He's a big man with a big heart who was a friend to all. I concluded that memorial statement, which I incidentally wrote, with these words. Donald and his wife, Janice, have endeared themselves to all in the court family. We're delighted to have served with Donald Ross. A short time later, at a portrait hanging of Judge Ross's portrait in Omaha, he was awarded the Herbert Holly Award for Outstanding Service to the Judiciary, and also he received a little bit later an honorary doctor's degree from the University of Nebraska. Those were honors he richly deserved. I want to tell you that Judge Ross and I became the closest of friends. I attended his initiation, you might say, or induction in January of 1971, thinking I wanted to meet this person who's going to take my place as the youngest and least senior judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals. I shouldn't say the youngest, because we did have a younger one in Don Lay from Omaha. And I was surprised. It was like electricity when we met, for we became the very, very closest of friends. His wife, Janice, and Don, and my wife, Fritzy Francis, as her real name, and I spent many times together, both in our homes in Fargo, in their home, in Omaha, in their summer home, or winter home, I should say, in Arizona, and in our respective lake homes, his in Alexandria, and mine near Detroit Lakes, Minnesota. We had a close relationship, and I want to tell you, as a judge, he was a remarkable person. I want to mention one case, and that's a remarkable case in which he deserves, I think, the credit, even though he will get none except that which I give him in these remarks today. The case is called Green v. McDonnell Douglas. And the issue in that case was, what test does a judge or jury use in determining that an employer or a respective employer of a minority person has refused that person a job for either a valid reason or, in fact, hidden discrimination? So it's the theory of hidden discrimination that we had to address. I served on the panel on that court with Judge Donald Lay of Omaha and Judge Harvey Johnson, also of Omaha. We disagreed. Judge Lay and I proposed a test that Harvey Johnson disagreed with, and Harvey wrote a very harsh dissent, and a strong dissent. And it looked like the case would that we had written would be set aside by an in-bank hearing of the whole court, because our test was probably a little bit too favorable to the employee and not the employer. And Don Lay said, "This Myron, this case is going to go in bank, but why don't you talk to Don Ross about it and see what he thinks?" So I called him, and I said, "Don, are you going to vote for a rehearing in bank?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, what's wrong with our opinion?" And he told me. And I said, "Well, have you got some ideas?" He said, "Yes." So he wrote out the test for hidden discrimination, which essentially is that if a minority person or a woman or anybody else protected by the law applies for a job and is turned down and is qualified for the job, that makes out a prima facie case. However, the prospective employee does not win if the employer has a legitimate reason not to hire that person. And if the employer states a reason, then the employee has the right to show its protection. That was essentially the test, and that was the test proposed by Judge Ross. And I said, "You know, Don, that's pretty good. I like it. And write it out for me, and I'm going to put it in my opinion." And I did. He did, and I did. And it didn't go in bank, and that was the opinion in the Eighth Circuit. But what do you know? The employer, McDonnell Douglas, took the case to the United States Supreme Court. And the United States Supreme Court, in its opinion, essentially adopted everything that Judge Ross had mentioned and everything that he had written. And that case is one of the really important cases in the annals of the Supreme Court and in the annals of what is good and what is the law regarding discrimination. Justice Powell, who wrote for the Supreme Court, has he gets the credit for it. The case has been cited over 135,000 times in other cases as the law of the land. I don't get any credit, but the real credit should go to Judge Ross. He doesn't get any credit at all because he was not on the panel. So even if they read the Eighth Circuit panel, they would not know about Judge Ross. The only way you'll hear about it is from what I say today and what I also said at Judge Ross's hanging of his portrait back in 1987. And I have this final statement. Ross was the best friend I ever had in my lifetime. We were together as judges for 16 and a half years when he was an active judge. And we were friends from that time on to the date of his death in December of 2013. And I have wonderful memories, and I know you that know him and his family has wonderful family, has wonderful memories. His four girls, their spouses, his son, Dean, and his wife, Don's 14 grandchildren and 17 great-grandchildren. Don and I, comrade in arms, comrades on the U.S., on the courts of these United States, was such a wonderful friend. I really salute him and say, Don, you are the greatest of the great generation. Thank you.
I'd like to briefly depart from your program. I know that Judy Langfelt, Judge Ross's secretary, is here, and numerous of his law clerks are here. And I'd like Judy, where are you? Judy, stand up, please. And Judge Ross's former law clerks, would you stand and be recognized, please? Judge Myers, where are you? Stand up there. Thank you all for attending. I urge you to ask Judge Myers how he came to clerk for Judge Ross for 2 or 3 months. It's a story that begins with enormous sadness and ends, I suppose, in a bittersweet way. The judge is here today to recognize the kindness that Judge Ross exhibited to him during a horrible period of his time. This is a young man who clerked for Chief Judge Oaks, who clerked for Harry Blackmun, who prior to being confirmed to the district court in Connecticut this last month, was a law teacher at Yale, a brilliant young man, and someone who is indebted to Judge Ross for just simple kindness. I'll let Judge Myers tell you this story. I'd urge you to ask him. All right. Becky Ross is one of the judge's daughters. She practices law with Troutman Sanders, which is an international law firm with more than 600 lawyers and offices located throughout the United States and China. Becky is the managing partner of the firm's Chicago office, and she chairs the litigation section for the firm. She has more than 35 years of civil litigation experience at both the trial and appellate levels. Becky's going to talk about her dad. Becky?
Thank you very much. May it please the court. On behalf of my extended family, I want to thank the court for holding this service honoring my father. As other speakers have made clear, my father had a truly amazing life. He grew up very quickly in World War II and went on to have an outstanding legal career, culminating in his appointment to the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. But as distinguished as my dad's career was, I would like to talk about him as a father and a role model. My dad, whom we all called Peaches because of his great love for that fruit, grew up in an era when men made the living and women made the dinner. It was not a time when men spent a lot of time with their children when they were young. They were the disciplinarians, not the friends. It is therefore difficult to talk about my father without also talking about my mother. For together, they were truly a formidable team. Dad married Mom in 1943, and they were together for more than 70 years until Dad's death in December. As you've heard, they had 5 children, 14 grandchildren, 17 great-grandchildren. While Mom had the primary responsibility for raising the kids, Dad set the standards. Dad had an unerring sense of responsibility. He believed that nothing was more important than your word. You knew that if he told you something, it was true. He owned up to his mistakes, even with his children. Dad had an unusual ability to let you know that he too had failed before, that he too had made mistakes. But the answer to mistakes was to pick yourself up, own up to the error, a very important part, and try again. No one in our family was allowed to fail without trying again. Dad made sure of that. And Mom was with him, telling you that she was sure that you would succeed next time. Dad had an incredible sense of loyalty to his family. He used to say over and over and over again, "No matter what you do, from murder on down, I will always be there for you." I used to wonder, why did he think I was going to become a murderer? But I never wondered if he was going to be in my corner. Dad expected you to succeed. All through school, when we came home with report cards, Dad would look at the card and then ask about the 1B. He would never comment on the A's. We thought he was ridiculous, unappreciative, demanding. But then Mom would come in and say he didn't comment on the A's because those were expected. Dad thought his job was setting expectations. Mom's job was making sure that we knew we could achieve those expectations. Dad was very fair. Others have commented on the fact that his judicial robe was embroidered with the words, "Do whatever is right." Those words do describe him as a judge. He prized fairness above all other qualities. He understood politics, but politics had no place in his view of the judiciary. But the saying also describes him as a dad. He was strong, opinionated, demanding, but above all else, he was fair. He would listen to what you had to say, argue with you, but ultimately, he did whatever was right. Dad was a larger-than-life man. He had a big laugh and a love of life. He really enjoyed playing elaborate tricks on his friends. He was an avid golfer and a frustrated architect. He loved limericks, the dirtier the better. And he had an amazing repertoire of limericks. He also loved to sing some of the off-color songs he learned in the service. I would tell you which ones those were, but even their names make me blush. He loved arguing politics, negotiating deals, and putting together coalitions to accomplish whatever he thought needed to be done. My mother worked with him, acting as his sounding board, making suggestions, and ultimately believing in him and supporting him at every point. I said that my father grew up at a time when women's roles were very limited. When I decided that I wanted to go to law school in 1973, I would not say that Dad was thrilled. However, after I got into law school, he changed. He offered me briefs to read in sex discrimination cases. When I had my arguments ready, we would discuss the case at length. I learned what it was like to look at both sides of an issue and to argue a side of a case that you were not personally in favor of. After the opinion came out, Dad would send me a copy so that I could see what he had decided. I was really in awe, seeing do whatever's right, up close and personal. In the last years of Dad's life, he spent a lot of time thinking about his life. Over and over again, he would talk about what a good job Mom did. He would tell each of his children and grandchildren how proud he was, how much he loved them. My father did have an incredible career, but what I remember most is Peaches, the dad, and how much he loved my mother and all of us. Thank you.
Justice Ken Stephan is one of the most highly respected members of the Nebraska Supreme Court. He's also married to Sharon, another Ross daughter. Ken, we look forward to your remarks.
Thank you, Judge Cuff. May it please the court. My lineage to Judge Ross is slightly different, maybe not quite as direct as Judge Riley's, but a slightly longer duration and a whole lot more fun. I first met Don Ross in the spring of 1968, that tumultuous year that Judge Smithkamp mentioned. Sharon and I had been dating just a few months at that time. I was a little apprehensive about this first meeting. In fact, maybe fear would be a better word. You know, on the one hand, there was the big bear, Don Ross, decorated World War II combat veteran, former mayor of Lexington, Nebraska, former U.S. attorney, partner with Judge Smithkamp's father in a prominent Omaha law firm, vice chair of the National Republican Party, and currently at that time in charge of the arrangements for the Republican National Convention held that summer. And then on the other hand, there was me, a scrawny, about to be drafted first-year law student with a short resume, an even shorter bank account, and designs on his daughter. And to make my circumstances even more precarious, I was a Democrat. But as it turned out, my anxiety was unnecessary. At that first meeting, Don greeted me with the warmth and cordiality that marked our relationship for the next 45 years. My own father died when I was young, so Don was the paternal influence throughout my adult life, and he was a wonderful father-in-law. He gave me good advice when I asked for it, but only when I asked for it. He supported me in everything that I did or tried to do, whether I asked him to or not. And he was never critical, even when he had good reason to be. When I became a judge 17 years ago, Don and Janice gave me the robe that I still wear today. And inside that robe are the same words that Becky mentioned were inscribed in Don's robe: do whatever's right. He administered the oath of office at my robing ceremony, and over the years he passed along various tidbits of judicial wisdom, probably the most important of which was be sure to have all your opinions written and approved by the middle of June. I think one of Don's favorite places on earth was the house that he and Janice built on Lake Carlos in Minnesota, near Alexandria, Minnesota. As many of you know, Don loved to design and build houses, brown houses, lots of them. But I think he regarded the house on Lake Carlos as perhaps his crowning architectural achievement, and I would certainly agree with that. About this time each year, as we began thinking of warmer weather, Don would start talking about going north. And every summer for many, many years, he and Janice would host children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, three generations of Ross family freeloaders to their wonderful home in Alexandria, Minnesota. And we all have wonderful memories of those years. One of mine is Don sitting on the deck in the evening asking everyone what they had done that day, how many fish they had caught, whether they'd been water skiing, what they were going to do the next day. And he just so obviously loved that moment, that family moment. He presided over the family dinner table there, putting away significant quantities of sweet corn and ice cream topped with peaches. And sometimes I would ask him if all the noise and clutter from all those grandchildren was driving him nuts, because it was driving me nuts. And he would say, "That's why we built it." For several years after Don stopped driving, I would drive him to Alexandria for the summer. We would take his spacious blue Cadillac, and he would recline the passenger seat almost all the way back into the rear seat to accommodate his perpetually sore back that he suffered from for many years. And of course, this left no room in the back seat for anyone else, so Sharon and Janice had to take another car, and they always made a lot better time than we did. Our summer drives fell into a familiar and pleasant pattern. From Omaha to about Sioux City, we covered various general topics. He would ask me if we'd heard any interesting cases recently and whether I was caught up on my opinions and about my relationship with the other judges on our court. And he would tell me of his relationships with the judges on his court, and certainly many fond memories of his time with Judge Bright and Judge Webster. He often spoke of his current and former law clerks, whose loyalty and friendship over the years he treasured. And sometimes he would talk a little about his wartime experiences as a B-17 bombardier. Then, heading north out of Sioux City, Don would turn to stories about Republican politics in the 1950s and 1960s. He would talk about his role in reshaping the party after the 1964 election, and his dealings with George Romney, Nelson Rockefeller, Ray Bliss, and many others. It was fascinating first-person history, but I often thought how difficult it must have been for him to transition from that active political life to the relatively isolated routine of an appellate judge. But I know that he found that his judicial career was equally rewarding in different ways. Then sometime, somewhere in the rolling farmland of southwest Minnesota, our conversation would always turn to family. Don would speak of what a good wife and mother Janice had been and how proud he was of each of his children and their spouses. He would ask me about our children, and we would talk about all of his grandchildren, and then he would always turn to me and say, "Boy, we're really lucky." And I would say, "Yeah, we really are." So today, Don Ross's family is pleased to join Judge Ross's court family in remembering his exemplary life and how lucky we were to be a part of it. Even those who knew Don Ross casually will remember him as a big man who accomplished many big things over his long lifetime. But those of us who are closest to him, his family and his court family, will also remember him as a man with a big heart, and we'll all miss him. Thank you.
When I met with Judge Ross and Janice, the judge had someone in particular that he wanted me to exercise whatever persuasive abilities I had to convince him to speak. Judge Roger Woolman is well known for his reticence and humility, and Ross said, "Don't let that stand in the way." You make him speak. Judge Ross held Judge Woolman in the highest esteem, and I think that was largely because of Roger's traits of civility, kindness, decency, collegiality, and good old South Dakota common sense. Judge Woolman, we look forward to your remarks.
Thank you, Judge Kopp, Chief Judge Riley, Chief Judge Smithcamp, members of the Ross family, and friends all. It has been said that the impressions we form when meeting someone for the first time stay with us for years. I met Judge Ross briefly on three occasions prior to my joining this court in September of 1985. I was serving on the state bench at the time and had no idea that someday I would be privileged to serve with him on the Court of Appeals. Had I reduced to writing my impressions formed on those occasions, they would have been something like this. He has the large man's quiet sense of self-confidence and presence, yet he seems to be without the arrogant aloofness that some men of similar statutes project. He is a formidable figure, not a man to be trifled with, and probably not given to levity in public settings. When I joined the court, I wondered what he would be like as a colleague. I soon learned that I was serving with a man of outstanding ability and superb judgment. I also learned that behind that sometimes gruff exterior was a person of warmth and encouragement, as when I confided in him several months after joining the court, that notwithstanding my 14 and a half years of service on the state Supreme Court, I was finding the pace of the work almost overwhelming. He responded by saying that he had had similar feelings during his first few months on the court, and with a few quiet words indicated that all would go well with me. Judge Bright's magnificent tribute refers to Judge Ross's military service. I too will refer to it because I believe that his experiences as the lead bombardier of his bomb squadron and later as the group squadron leader influenced his entire career. I had heard about his military service but was afraid to ask him about it, knowing full well that many people who have seen combat are reluctant to talk about it. Sometime during my first few months in the court, I mentioned to him that I had earlier seen on late night television the movie 12 O'Clock High. The movie, for those of you who have seen it, contains harrowing scenes of actual combat filmed by the aircraft taking part in the bombing mission. Bombers being riddled by the flak from the exploding anti-aircraft shells, parachute-clad crew members leaping from their stricken craft, bomber spiraling towards the earth. Using the movie as a lead-in, I asked Judge Ross whether he had ever seen it. Naively it was, to say the ask. He smiled quietly and replied, many times. He replied that it was the inevitable bursts of flak as they approached the target area, which he dreaded the most. And then, as though describing being struck by hailstone while mowing the backyard, he said that on one mission, a piece of flak had come through the canopy where he was seated and lodged beneath his skin. I then asked, Don, weren't you terribly frightened on those missions? To which he replied, and I can hear his voice today, Roger, I was 21 years old, and I thought that I was invincible. He went on to mention that he had volunteered for that second tour of duty after his first tour had ended. Reading the look of wonderment on my face, that one would have voluntarily exposed himself to the additional dangers, he explained, I hope that every time we dropped our bombs, that we would be bringing the war one day closer to its end. What was it like then to sit with Judge Ross as he presided over a three-judge panel of our court? Well, in a word, he ran a tight courtroom. I think it is fair to say that jocularity was not his hallmark as a presiding judge. Nor was subtlety. He was laconic, occasionally sardonic, but rarely sarcastic. He did not regard his seat on the bench as a bully pulpit from which he could expound at length on the good, the true, and the beautiful. For him, oral argument was a time to consider serious issues. Thus, he could be abrupt, brusque, and at times impatient. But when he expressed impatience, it was expressed for the purpose of moving the case along, of not wasting the courts or the remaining litigants' time. His wartime experience had given him an acute sense of the irretrievability of past time. He was keenly aware of the importance of, as the King James Version has it, redeeming the time. After all, 1 mile past the target point was a mile too far, and 1 minute past that point was a minute too late. His manner of presiding was to ensure that counsel were aware that it was their duty to sharpen the facts and issues and not to obscure them. He had no need to raise his voice to command attention, for his presence while seated on the bench was as formidable, if not to say at times fearsome, as it was when he entered the courtroom. Two vignettes of my experience with him in the courtroom. As those who knew him will attest, Judge Ross was not given to histrionics, neither on his part nor on counsel's part. I remember a case that was being argued in one of the small courtrooms in the old St. Louis courthouse. I don't remember the details of the case, but appellant's counsel apparently thought that it would strengthen his presentation by using dramatic gestures, augmented by taking half steps to the rearward while making them, to the point where he stood some 3 or 4 feet behind the lectern, whereupon Judge Ross said, and I'm tempted to say growled, "Get back to the podium, counsel," which of course counsel did, all the while expressing apologies for his behavior. In contrast to the cross-bench exchanges that occur during the arguments at the U.S. Supreme Court these days, I don't recall that Judge Ross often commented on another panel member's comments or questions during oral argument. I do remember with one great clarity one occasion, however, when he did so while Judge Bright and I were sitting with him in that same small courtroom in St. Louis. Again, I don't remember what the case was about, but it soon became apparent to even the most casual observer in the courtroom that Judge Bright had developed a decidedly favorable view of one side of the case, to the point that he began throwing out softball questions to counsel, the wording of which was, of course, designed to prompt answers supportive of Judge Bright's view of the case. After hearing 3 or 4 of those, Judge Ross proclaimed in a voice loud enough to be heard by all, "Well, I can see that Judge Bright has already made up his mind in this case." To which Judge Bright replied gently, "Oh, Don, that's not true." The oral argument continued without incident, and when it was completed, we rose from the bench to retire for the morning. The door to the roving room had not yet closed behind him when Judge Ross burst out in a contrite voice, "I'm sorry, Mike." And of course, all was forgiven between these two old friends, and we went on with our case conference. I have often thought about that incident, saying to myself, if only the lawyers who knew only the Judge Ross of the courtroom could learn to know him as the Judge Ross we knew in the conference room and in chambers. I don't know what prompted this comment, but Judge Ross once mentioned to me that he had designed and built several houses. I understand that it was a matter of some amusement among the members of the family. As with his house plans, Judge Ross applied his architect's eye when structuring his opinions, where form followed function, and in which the facts, the issues, the reasoning, and the conclusions followed in logically sequential order. As the tribute included with the program here today points out, one sees in his opinions the work of a brilliant but practical mind striving to achieve principal consensus. A paradigm example of that work is found in the role he played in helping to craft the opinion in Green versus McDonnell Douglas, as described in Judge Bright's eloquent, heartfelt explanation of that case this afternoon. Judge Ross did not include in his opinions any of the rhetorical flourishes that look so beguilingly clever and witty when read in the typescript of slip opinions, but which are the cause of such rueful chagrin when read years later in the cold, unchangeable pages of the bound volumes of the Federal Reporter. One looks in vain in his opinions for any gossamer flights of fancy or for any epigrammatic generalizations. There was no need to parse the phrases of his opinions, which were models of conciseness and directness of expression. His was a practical, pragmatic approach to the judicial process. As it was with his opinions for the panel and for the en banc court, so it was with his dissenting opinions. They were brief, sometimes pointed, but never overwrought or polemical. I always envied Judge Ross's ability to cut through to the heart of a case. He had that unerring sense of the relevant that is the mark of every great lawyer and judge, a feel for the law, if you will. Whatever indecision about the outcome of a case he may have felt when preparing for oral argument had long since been put to rest by the time he expressed his views during our post-argument conferences. Judge Ross was a proud man, proud in the best sense of that word. He once told me that the three things that he was most proud of in his life were the oath he took as an officer in the United States Army Air Corps, his oath as a U.S. Attorney for the District of Nebraska, and his oath as a United States Circuit Judge for the Eighth Circuit. What honor, dignity, and courage he brought to all three of those roles. Unless one has been a member of a multi-member court, it is hard to appreciate fully the importance of the camaraderie and collegiality that make that experience so rewarding and life-fulfilling. To be able to disagree without being disagreeable, to be firm in one's views, yet respectful of the views of others, are the hallmarks of collegiality. And these qualities Judge Ross possessed in full measure. But beyond that, his overarching sense of mission and purpose, his fierce intellectual honesty, his dedication to duty, and the strength of his character made him an inspiring, endearing colleague. Overlying all of those characteristics was the warmth of personality and the sometimes self-deprecating, wry sense of humor that was revealed to those of us who learned to know him well. To be accorded his respect was an achievement highly to be desired. To be welcomed into the inner circle of his friendship was to be given a pearl of great price. Of Judge Ross, it can truly be said that all who knew him admired and respected him, and even more truly, that all of us who learned to know him well loved him. If I may be given a final moment of personal reflection, as his health worsened and he was no longer able to attend court functions, I would keep in touch with him through letters and birthday phone calls. As the judge became weaker with each passing years, I would first call Judge Kopf and then Justice Stefan to learn whether I should call. When I called them early last June, I learned that although the judge had become quite weak, I should feel free to call him on his birthday. And so, on the day before his 91st birthday, I called him. I visited with Janice briefly. And then when he came on the line, the judge's voice was weak, but his mind was as clear as ever. And after I had expressed my birthday congratulations, he, as always, asked how things were on the court. I told him that all was going well, and then, referring to then-judge-designate Jane Kelly, I told him how all of us were looking forward to having her join our court later that summer. And then, in a moment of thoughtlessness, I said, "Don, she's only 48. I'm starting to feel old." Realizing what I had just said, I paused for a moment, and then, his wry sense of humor strong to the end, he chuckled softly and replied, "I know the feeling." After our conversation ended, I sat for a few minutes, wondering whether I would ever be able to speak with him again. And so it was, when we learned the news of his passing last December, I again sat for a few minutes, recalling the many conversations that the two of us had over the years. I then took comfort from the knowledge that his final flight safely landed, that invincible airman was now at rest. As we honor the memory of his lifetime of service to his state, his country, and to this court, let us resolve to, in our lives and careers, strive to meet the example of dedication to duty that Judge Donald R. Ross, through his life and career, set for us all.
One of the great pleasures of my life, Judge Woolman, was the first time I sat with the Court of Appeals by designation. And it was you and I and Judge Ross, and I still have that faded Polaroid that was taken in the chambers. And I thank you for your kindness. as I know that all of Judge Ross's family and friends. Thank you. It's my privilege now to call upon Staff Sergeant Carl Eitzen to grace us with the Air Force song. Staff Sergeant? Chief Judge Riley.
Well, if you did not know before, you know now that Donald R. Ross was a great American and a great human being. And we all will miss him, but we cherish the time we had with him. Before we adjourn, I want to thank a few people. I want to thank First Staff Sergeant Carl Eitzen for his instrumental playing. Thank all of our speakers today. They were all superb. Also want to thank, this doesn't just happen. There are a lot of people behind the scenes that make these sessions come off. Millie Adams, our circuit executive, and her staff, Millie's seated over here, have worked hard on it. Especially Susie Cordero from the Administrative Specialist for the District of Nebraska. Is Susie in here? She worked very, very hard at getting this organized. My secretary, Chris Schneis, my judicial assistant, also worked long and hard. Wayne Beck, our court technology specialist, who pulled everything together. Wayne, thank you. And of course, our master of ceremonies, Judge Cuff. Thank you very much. I should also tell you there's a reception immediately following on the first floor rotunda, and we hope to see you all down there following the service. With that, I thank you all for coming, and we are in adjournment.